picture this in your mind. I want you to really visualize this because it sets the entire stage for what we are exploring today.
Yeah, visualization is key for this one.
Right. So you are looking at this breathtaking, deeply intricate image. At the very bottom, down in the darkest depths of the frame, there is a single glowing cellular core.
Mm.
It looks totally microscopic, like something you would only ever see through the lens of a high-powered electron microscope. And it's pulsing with this brilliant golden light. It feels alive.
Very vibrant.
Exactly. But as you watch it, these glowing threads start to reach out from that single cell. They move upward. They're branching out, intertwining. And you suddenly realize that this microscopic cell, well, it's acting as the root system for something unimaginably massive.
Right. It's not just a cell.
No, it is feeding into a colossal, luminous tree of life. And as your eyes travel up the glowing trunk and into the sprawling branches, you don't just see leaves. You see human figures holding hands, forming these intricate social connections.
Which is such a powerful metaphor.
It really is. You see complex architecture up there, too. Buildings, homes, schools, hospitals, all nestled in the boughs of this tree. You see winding blue rivers flowing right through the canopy.
Yeah, the whole ecosystem.
Yeah, the whole thing. And eventually, the very top of this incredible tree forms the entire curved surface of the Earth, hovering in space, gleaming and interconnected. It's just a stunning visual representation of how a single microscopic spark of biology is, well, it's entirely inseparable from the grandest scales of human society and the planet itself.
It is an incredibly captivating visual. And honestly, it does so much heavy lifting before we even look at a single piece of text today.
Yeah, it sets the mood perfectly.
It does, because that image visualizes an unbroken, continuous thread.
Yeah.
I mean, we spend so much time in modern society completely compartmentalizing the world, right?
Yeah.
We put biology in one box, sociology in another box, ecology in a third.
Right. Everyone has their own little silo.
Exactly. But that glowing tree, it forces you to confront the reality that the smallest biological repair happening inside a human body is fundamentally tethered to the vast, complex world outside of it.
You literally can't separate them.
No, you cannot separate the cell from the soil or the person from the planetary ecosystem that sustains them.
That is the perfect starting point for us. So welcome to our deep dive. Whether you are listening to prep for a major strategic meeting or catching up on the latest systemic frameworks in healthcare, or, you know, maybe you are just insanely curious about how the systems of the world actually interact.
Which is a great reason to be here.
Always. Our mission today is to take you on a journey through a truly groundbreaking piece of literature. We are unpacking a comprehensive 2026 conceptual framework and landscape review written by Dr. Bichara Sahili.
And it's a massive paper.
Huge. It's titled, From Competent Physicians to Healing Societies, a life-grounded framework for medical education, distributed accountability, and planetary flourishing. And I am telling you, this paper completely flips the script on how we measure success, not just in medicine, but in how we actually structure society.
It really does. It tackles a very uncomfortable reality that anyone who interacts with modern healthcare eventually notices. The paper refers to this as the core paradox of medical education.
The core paradox. Break that down for us.
So for decades, we have built medical schools and training programs that are, frankly, they are spectacularly effective at producing technically competent doctors.
Right.
I mean, these are brilliant professionals. They can accurately diagnose a bafflingly complex disease. They can prescribe highly targeted pharmacological interventions. And they perform surgeries that, well, a century ago, they would have been considered literal magic.
Yeah, we have basically mastered the art of fixing the biological machine.
We really have. But that brings us to the paradox.
Yeah.
Competent clinical intervention, no matter how advanced, does not reliably generate actual health.
Wow, wait.
Yeah. You can repair the biological machine with absolute precision, but if the relational, institutional, and ecological conditions that surround that human being remain fundamentally impaired, that person cannot actually heal.
So the intervention works, but the person doesn't get better.
Right. The intervention might keep them breathing, sure, but it doesn't return them to a state of health.
Okay, let's unpack this because that is a massive claim. We are basically looking at a framework that says executing the medicine flawlessly isn't enough to make a person well.
That's exactly what it's saying.
That almost feels like a betrayal of everything we've been taught to expect from going to the doctor. Like, I go to the doctor, they give me the pill, I get better.
It definitely disrupts that traditional expectation.
Yeah.
Dr. Sahili is proposing what is called a life-grounded framework. And the objective here is to bridge an enormous chasm.
What's on either side of the chasm?
Well, on one side, you have the fixing of a biological body. So the patient in the hospital gown receiving treatment. On the other side of the chasm, you have the repair of the real-world conditions that allow that person's life to actually continue and flourish once they leave the hospital.
So the world they go back to.
Exactly. We are talking about their relationships, the safety of their housing, the institutions they rely on to survive, and the ecological stability of the environment they breathe in. The argument is that we have to abandon the idea of healing as an isolated individual biological event.
Because it's not just happening inside a vacuum.
Right. Healing is an emergent property. It only happens when all these interconnected systems work in tandem.
Okay, so to really wrap our heads around this massive systemic shift, the paper points out that we first have to look at a very specific, incredibly common clinical failure.
Yes, the asthma scenario.
Right. The author gives us this narrative anchor, a composite scenario that literally plays out every single day in emergency rooms all over the world. So let's walk through it because it perfectly illustrates this gap between competence and healing.
Okay, let's hear it.
Imagine a child comes into the ER. They are having a severe asthma attack. And anyone who has ever witnessed this knows how terrifying it is. The child is fighting for every breath. The parents are panicked. The stress in the room is just palpable.
And the clinical team springs into action.
Yeah.
And the text makes a point to emphasize that this team does everything right. There is absolutely no malpractice here.
Right. They are competent.
Totally competent. Yeah. They rapidly recognize the respiratory distress. They administer the exact evidence-based treatments of perhaps oxygen, bronchodilators, systemic corticosteroids. They reassess the child's vitals meticulously.
Textbook perfect.
Exactly. They communicate empathetically with the family. They document everything in the electronic health record flawlessly, and they set up the appropriate follow-up appointments with a pediatrician. By every existing metric of medical education, this is a textbook example of clinical competence. The child's airways open up, their breathing stabilizes, and they are safely discharged.
It looks like a total success story. The system functioned exactly as it was designed to.
Right, but...
But then the paper forces us to look at what happens next. 3 weeks later, that exact same child is back in the exact same ER, struggling for breath with another severe asthma exacerbation.
And why is that?
Because the apartment they were discharged to is incredibly damp. The walls are literally blooming with toxic mold. The landlord has repeatedly ignored requests to fix the leaking pipe causing all the moisture. And the family, well, they simply cannot afford the security deposit to move to a safer, cleaner building.
And this scenario introduces a foundational concept of the framework. It's called the competency sufficiency error.
The competency sufficiency error. It sounds like a logical fallacy that a whole industry has just blindly accepted.
It is a profound logical trap. The error lies in the false assumption that just because competent care is necessary for a good outcome, it is therefore sufficient to produce health.
Ah, necessary versus sufficient.
Exactly. The medical team in the ER was absolutely necessary. I mean, if they hadn't intervened competently, that child might not have survived the night. But their clinical competence was not sufficient to produce health.
Because of the apartment.
Right. Because the medical intervention merely interrupted a dangerous biological episode. It did absolutely nothing to alter the environmental conditions that are endlessly regenerating that very same episode.
I'm trying to picture this in everyday terms. It is like bailing water out of a sinking boat with an incredibly high-tech, perfectly engineered bucket, but completely ignoring the gaping hole in the hull.
It's a great way to look at it.
Like, you are doing a phenomenal job bailing, and you are exhausted from bailing, but you are never going to stop the boat from sinking.
That analogy hits the nail on the head. And to understand why we keep bailing water without addressing the hole, the paper argues that the medical field desperately needs a vocabulary realignment.
A vocabulary realignment.
Yeah, because the terms we use shape the goals we pursue. Right now, we conflate words in healthcare all the time. And Saley argues that this linguistic confusion obscures the actual educational and systemic problem. The paper meticulously breaks down these distinctions, starting with the word disease.
Right. So in the paper, disease is defined as an identifiable biological disturbance or dysfunction. It's the tangible, measurable thing, like what shows up on an MRI or in a blood panel.
Yes.
In the case of the child, it's the acute inflammation and bronchospasm in their airways.
Right. And moving from that, we have the concept of cure. A cure is the decisive elimination or the total reversal of that specific disease process.
So getting rid of it entirely.
Exactly. You eradicate the bacteria or you surgically remove the inflamed appendix. The biological disturbance is just gone.
But then we get to health, and this is where the framework really starts to pivot away from the traditional medical model. The paper defines health as life capacity enabled.
Life capacity enabled, yes.
I want to linger on that for a second. It is not defining health as a negative. It isn't just the absence of disease. It's defined as a positive capability. It's what a person or even a community is substantively able to do, to be, to function, and to adapt to the challenges of living.
That positive definition of health leads directly into the definition of healing. Healing in this framework is defined as the restoration, regeneration, adaptation, or just transformation of those conditions and capacities.
Notice the active nature of that definition.
Very active.
Healing is a continuous process of restoring a person's life capacity. It isn't just erasing a pathogen and sending them on their way.
And the final term in this continuum is flourishing, which the text describes as life capacity meaningfully expressed. That feels like the ultimate goal, not just surviving, not just functioning, but actually living a life full of meaning and agency.
Okay, I love that. But I need to pause here and push back on these definitions for a second, because if I am reading this strictly, wait, someone can be healed without being cured.
Yes.
Really?
Yes, and that is perhaps one of the most crucial and paradigm-shifting distinctions in this entire framework.
Mm-hmm.
The paper explicitly confirms that healing and curing are not the same thing, and you can absolutely have one without the other.
Okay, give me an example of that.
Well, consider a person living with a severe chronic illness, or maybe an irreversible spinal cord injury, or a terminal cancer diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
By strict medical definition, they cannot be cured.
Right. The biology isn't going back to how it was.
Exactly. The biological disease process or the physical alteration cannot be eliminated.
Mm.
But can they experience healing? The framework says absolutely yes.
How does that actually manifest, though? If the biology is still damaged, what does the healing look like?
Healing for that person might look like achieving adequate, dignified symptom relief. It might look like restored agency over their daily choices. It could be establishing deep trust and open communication with their care team, gaining access to practical physical supports.
Like mobility aids or home modifications.
Exactly. Or repairing fractured relationships with their family and moving into an environment that is fully accessible and accommodates their physical needs.
Mm-hmm.
They are actively healing because their life capacity, their ability to function, adapt, and find meaning is being relentlessly supported and restored, even while the biological disease remains present.
Wow. That reframes the entire purpose of care for millions of people. It means a doctor doesn't just throw their hands up and say there's nothing more we can do just because the cure is off the table.
Absolutely. And the paper goes even further by pointing out that the reverse scenario is equally true and often devastating.
Cured but not healed.
Exactly. A person could be physically cured of a disease, say the tumor is successfully irradiated or the severe infection is eradicated by antibiotics, but they might be left dealing with profound medical trauma from the interventions.
Oh, wow. I didn't even think about that.
Right. Or they might face absolute financial ruin from the medical bills, leading to eviction. Or maybe they face social abandonment because their illness alienated their support network.
So they're cured, but their life is falling apart.
In that scenario, the patient is technically cured of the biological disturbance, but their healing is utterly unfinished. Their life capacity has been devastated by the process of getting the cure.
Cured, but left completely broken by the system.
Exactly. And Sahili stresses that embedding this distinction into medical education is vital to protect against ableism.
Tell me more about that.
Well, the paper explicitly states that disability is not a moral failure, nor is it an inherent defect that must be eliminated before a person is allowed to flourish. Very often, it is the inaccessible physical environments, the discriminatory social assumptions, and the institutional exclusions that disable a person's life capacity far more severely than their actual physical impairment.
Right. The world disables them, not their body.
Exactly. Therefore, facilitating healing often requires a doctor to advocate for repairing the patient's environment and relationships rather than just endlessly trying to normalize the individual's biological body.
That completely changes the goalposts for what a healthcare system should be aiming for. If true healing requires so much more than just a biological cure, we really need to understand the mechanics of how the physical body interacts with the world outside the hospital walls.
And the paper dives deep into the biology and sociology of this interaction. It introduces two massive interlocking concepts: Selegenesis and Selutogenesis.
Okay, let's get into the mechanics. This section of the paper is where the theory gets grounded in actual biology, right?
Yes. It details the constant biological and environmental coupling that is required for any true recovery to happen. Well, let's start with the inside of the body. Selegenesis. This concept draws heavily on the work of Dr. Robert Nevio and his model of the healing cycle.
So selegenesis is the internal work. What does that actually mean at a cellular level? Like, what is the body doing?
Selegenesis is the organism's highly organized internal progression through molecular, cellular, and biological processes in order to recover after a disturbance or injury.
So it's a specific sequence.
Yes. When a threat is detected, the cells initiate a danger signaling cascade. This causes rapid shifts in cellular metabolism and triggers the inflammatory response. We often think of inflammation as bad, but it is an essential first step of selegenesis.
It's the body's alarm system.
Right. And after the threat is neutralized, the body must actively transition to the resolution of that inflammation and eventually move into tissue repair and functional reintegration. It is a highly active, metabolically expensive biological work that the body must execute to complete its recovery.
The key takeaway there is that recovery isn't passive. It isn't just about removing the initial injury, like pulling a thorn out of a finger and then nothing happens.
Right. The body doesn't just sit there.
The body actually has to run a complex software program to rebuild the tissue.
But the body cannot run that internal software program in a vacuum. It requires resources and safety signals. And that brings us to the outside of the body, selutogenesis.
The external environment.
Yes. The term selutogenesis was coined by the medical sociologist Aaron Antonovsky. It refers to the external field of health-generating affordances. It encompasses all the surrounding conditions in a person's life that make biological and psychological recovery materially possible.
So we are talking about the fundamentals here. Having a safe place to sleep, getting enough restorative rest, breathing clean air, having access to nutrient-dense food, maintaining strong social connections, and, well, feeling a baseline level of institutional trust in your society.
Exactly. Antonovsky summarized it as having access to the resources that make life comprehensible, manageable, and meaningful.
Mm.
If your external world is chaotic, threatening, and unmanageable, your body receives constant danger signals, which completely derails the internal selegenic healing cycle.
I'm trying to visualize how these two things work together. I'm thinking it's like a seed. So selegenesis feels like the genetic programming tucked inside a tiny seed that is trying to sprout.
Ooh, I like this.
Right. It has the internal instruction manual for how to grow roots, how to push a stem up through the earth, how to unfurl leaves. That's selegenesis. But selutogenesis is the soil, the ambient temperature, the sunlight, and the water around that seed.
Yes.
You can have a perfectly healthy, incredibly resilient seed with flawless genetic programming. But if you plant it in toxic, dry, compacted dirt, and lock it in a dark closet, it is never going to flourish. The seed's internal drive to live just isn't enough on its own if the environment is hostile.
What's fascinating here is how perfectly your seed analogy aligns with the scientific concept of organism-niche coupling.
Organism-niche coupling.
Yes. So Healy brings this into the framework from the biological theories of Humberto Maturana and Francisco Varela.
Organism-niche coupling. That sounds like something from an advanced ecology textbook. Let's break it down.
The core idea is actually quite intuitive. It posits that living systems, including human beings, are not just passive objects sitting in an environment that acts upon them from the outside.
Okay.
We don't just exist in a space. We exist through a space. We persist through constant, structurally coupled interactions with our media, our niche. Every breath we take, every drop of water we drink, every social interaction we have is an exchange with our niche that alters our internal biology.
So we're constantly in this dynamic, inescapable dance with our surroundings. Our biology is literally shaping itself around our environment, minute by minute.
Precisely. Therefore, the paper argues that a doctor cannot just command a body to heal by throwing pharmaceutical molecules at it. You have to support its adaptive recovery within its actual lived niche. The internal biological repair selegenesis and the external enabling condition selutogenesis are not two separate things. They are two complementary dimensions of one single practical problem.
The body has to do the repair, but the external world has to stop making that repair impossible.
Right. And Selusely strongly warns against falling into one of two symmetric errors when trying to grasp this coupling. The first trap is biological reductionism.
Which is what?
This is the historical default of Western medicine. It is the assumption that medical intervention is sufficient, completely, regardless of the toxic, unsafe, or impoverished conditions the patient is returning to. Is the ER team treating the child's asthma attack with steroids while remaining completely blind to the mold on the apartment walls?
It is believing that the pill is so powerful it will conquer the environment.
Exactly. The second trap is the mirror opposite, contextual reductionism. This is a trap that public health advocates or sociologists sometimes fall into.
How does that one work?
It is the assumption that if we just fix society, if we achieve perfect social reform, eliminate poverty, build perfect housing, and achieve total equity, then clinical diagnosis, surgical interventions, and medications become largely unnecessary because no one will get sick.
Believing that a perfect environment means the biological machine never breaks down.
Yes. And the paper points out that both extremes are dangerously wrong. A supportive community and a safe home cannot replace a necessary emergency appendectomy or a life-saving dose of insulin. Biology still fails.
Of course.
But conversely, a highly sophisticated anti-inflammatory biologic drug cannot endlessly compensate for chronic food insecurity, relentless sleep deprivation, or a contaminated living environment.
Well,
both the internal medical intervention and the external supportive context are absolutely non-negotiably required for healing to occur.
Okay. That makes perfect theoretical sense. I understand the logic. But if I put myself in the shoes of a medical professional, this brings up a massive flashing red flag.
I think I know where you're going with this.
Right. If I am an exhausted medical student or a resident working a grueling 80-hour week just trying to learn how to keep patients alive, this framework sounds terrifying. Are we asking an already overburdened doctor to suddenly become an expert urban planner, a housing rights lawyer, and a climate scientist on top of knowing the side effects of every medication?
It sounds impossible.
It feels like a recipe for ultimate catastrophic burnout. How is one physician supposed to manage the cellular biology and the entire external world?
It is a completely valid concern, and it is the most common critique of holistic medical models. The paper anticipates this anxiety and addresses it head on by introducing what Saheli calls the six nested levels of healing.
The six nested levels.
But before we get to the mechanism that actually protects the doctor from burnout, we have to understand these six levels because they illustrate how a failure at one single level cascades up and down through all the others.
The interconnected cascade. Okay, let's walk through these six nested levels so we can see how expansive this really is. What's level one?
Level one is the cellular and biological level. This is the microscopic territory we discussed with salugenesis. It involves the cellular danger response, the inflammatory cascade, mitochondrial function, and tissue repair.
Basic biology. So level two zooms out slightly to the organismal and functional level?
Yes, this is looking at the integrated organ systems, the patient's physical mobility, their ability to actually function in their daily life, and managing the physical burden or side effects of the medical treatments themselves. It's the whole physical body functioning as a unit.
Got it. Level three moves beyond the physical body into the psychosocial and relational level.
Right. This encompasses a patient's psychological sense of safety, their ability to trust others, their emotional regulation, their sense of personal agency, and the strength of their interpersonal connections with caregivers, family, and their immediate community.
Okay, and level four introduces time. This is the life course and intergenerational level.
Here, healing requires looking at developmental timing. It involves understanding the impact of adverse childhood experiences, the cumulative allostatic load of historical injuries, and even the epigenetic changes passed down across generations. It recognizes that a patient's health today is deeply influenced by what happened to their parents and grandparents.
That's a huge perspective shift. Level five zooms out even further to the institutional and community level.
Now we are talking about the massive physical and social structures that dictate everyday life. The availability of safe housing, food security, labor conditions, transportation infrastructure, the fairness of the legal system, and what the paper broadly calls the civil commons.
And finally, the widest lens, level six. The ecological and planetary level.
This is the ultimate life ground. We are talking about the foundational requirements for any life to exist.
Yeah.
Breathable air, drinkable water, climate stability, thriving biodiversity, and respecting the ecological limits of the planet.
Okay, so let's track a patient through this. A doctor is looking at a patient and realizes their cellular inflammation at level one is causing asthma at level two.
Yes.
But that asthma is inextricably connected to their damp apartment at level five. And that apartment is linked to historical redlining and discrimination at level 4, and maybe even climate-driven humidity increases at level 6.
Exactly.
I go back to my previous objection. Asking a doctor to trace and fix that entire causal chain is an impossible mandate.
So Curley completely agrees with you. The text explicitly states that trying to assign every social and environmental problem to individual doctors would effectively medicalize society.
Medicalize society.
Yes. It would take the massive failures of our political and economic institutions and dump them onto the shoulders of already overwhelmed clinicians. The solution to this impossible mandate is the core protective rule of the entire framework, the authority-resource obligation rule.
The authority-resource obligation rule. Let's dig into that because it sounds like the key to making this actually work in the real world. What does it mean?
The rule is elegant in its simplicity. It dictates that no actor, whether it is a first-year medical student, a seasoned attending physician, or a community clinic, should ever be assigned responsibility or obligation for a healing outcome unless they are simultaneously given the corresponding authority, the resources, and the institutional support required to actually achieve it.
Oh, that completely shifts the dynamic. You cannot be blamed or held accountable for a patient's moldy apartment if you don't possess the legal authority to compel the landlord or the financial resources to relocate the patient.
Exactly. To operationalize this protective rule, the paper breaks down systemic accountability into 4 distributed layers. This is how the framework actually relieves the immense burden on the individual doctor, rather than endlessly adding to it.
Let's trace how a problem moves through these 4 layers of accountability. What is layer 1?
Layer 1 is practitioner competence. This is the doctor-specific domain. The physician is responsible for accurate biological diagnosis, safe pharmacological treatment, effective communication, and this is the crucial addition, recognizing and documenting the structural barriers to healing.
So they don't have to fix the wall.
Exactly. The doctor doesn't have to personally fix the mold in the apartment, but they have the obligation to ask the patient about their housing, document the mold as a barrier to healing, and escalate that information.
That feels entirely manageable. I diagnose the asthma, I prescribe the inhaler, and I identify that housing is the barrier blocking the cure from becoming healing. I pass the baton. What happens at layer 2?
Layer 2 is collective competence. This represents the interprofessional healthcare team. It is never just one doctor acting alone. It is the nurses, the clinical social workers, the pharmacists, and the public health liaisons.
A whole team effort.
Right. Their collective job is to coordinate the care, share critical information across disciplines with the patient's consent, and smoothly manage the handoffs between different specialties and community services.
So the doctor passes the housing issue to the team's social worker, who has the specific expertise to navigate social services. But what if the social worker has too many cases or doesn't have anywhere to send the patient? That leads us to layer 3, I assume.
Yes. Layer 3 is institutional capability. This is the hospital, the university, or the regional health system itself. The institution holds the responsibility for providing the actual infrastructure that allows layers 1 and 2 to function.
So they build the bridge.
Exactly. The hospital must build and fund the referral pathways to housing agencies. They must establish medical legal partnerships to help patients fight evictions. They must hire the interpreters, and crucially, they must provide protected time in the schedule for clinicians to actually do this coordinating work without being penalized for seeing fewer patients.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because if the institution fails to provide the social worker or fails to fund the legal partnership, the doctor literally cannot do their job effectively.
They are completely blocked.
This framework flips the script. It holds the hospital accountable for enabling the doctor rather than just demanding the doctor work harder to overcome a broken hospital.
The paper explicitly states that an institution cannot claim to teach its medical students to care about housing insecurity if it refuses to give them a functional funded pathway to actually refer a patient for housing support. Teaching the theory without providing the infrastructure is an educational dead end.
It's just lip service at that point.
Completely. And finally, we reach layer 4, governance. This encompasses the government, public authorities, and policymakers. They hold the ultimate macro-level responsibility. They must protect human rights, enforce building and housing standards, adequately fund public services, and sustain the ecological limits of the region.
So it is a continuous chain. The doctor diagnoses the asthma and flags the mold. The team social worker processes the referral to the city housing agency. The hospital administration ensures that partnership with the housing agency is robust and funded, and the local government ensures there are actual laws forcing landlords to fix mold and budgets for affordable housing.
It is a model of distributed accountability. The enormous burden of healing society is shared across the system, and every individual actor is only judged and evaluated on the specific actions they actually have the power and resources to take.
That makes so much more sense than just telling doctors to be superheroes. It demands that the system does its part. But exploring the system's role brings up a really tough, uncomfortable reality. If the system is supposed to enable healing, we have to talk about what happens when the system is actually the thing causing the injury in the first place.
Yes. This is a heavy section of the paper where Saheeli tackles the darker side of salutogenesis, the reality of what happens when society actively, sometimes intentionally, prevents healing. And as we discuss this, we are looking specifically at Dr. Saheeli's theoretical framework and unpacking the sociological concepts used in the paper to explain systemic barriers to health.
Right. We are looking objectively at the research on how societal structures literally impact human biology. No sides, just the data as presented.
Exactly. The paper relies heavily on two specific concepts developed by the renowned sociologist Johann Galtung: structural violence and cultural violence.
Structural violence. That is a very evocative, heavy term. When we hear violence, we usually think of a physical assault, like someone hitting someone else. But that is not what this means, is it?
No, Galtung's concept of structural violence refers to how unequal social arrangements, deeply entrenched policies, and systemic exclusions become literally embodied by people as chronic disease, preventable suffering, and premature death.
Embodied as disease. Wow.
It is the violence of deep poverty, of systemic racism, or of intentional environmental degradation in marginalized neighborhoods. It is a societal arrangement that systematically denies specific groups of people the resources they fundamentally need to survive and heal, causing physiological harm just as surely as a physical blow would.
It is the violence of the system operating exactly as it was designed.
Yeah.
And how does cultural violence fit into that?
Cultural violence is the narrative.
Yeah.
It is the belief system, the ideology, or the rhetoric that society uses to legitimize the structural violence. It is the story we tell ourselves to make the unequal, harmful arrangement seem natural, normal, or even acceptable.
Give me a tangible example of how that dynamic plays out in a modern healthcare setting.
Consider a narrative that blames a patient's poverty entirely on their lack of personal responsibility or failure to work hard enough, completely ignoring the structural reality of suppressed wages or lack of generational wealth. Or, in a direct clinical setting, cultural violence is when a medical team labels a patient who repeatedly ends up in the ER as a non-compliant or non-adherent patient.
Because they aren't taking the medication they were prescribed.
Exactly. The label non-compliant places the blame entirely on the patient's character, but that label completely ignores the structural violence, the fact that they literally cannot afford the copay for the medication, or they live in a transit desert and cannot get to the pharmacy,
Yep.
or they are working three jobs to avoid eviction and simply cannot make it to clinic hours.
So the structural violence harms their biology by making care physically or financially inaccessible, and then the cultural violence blames their character for being harmed.
Exactly. Saheeli points out that once a medical professional recognizes this dynamic, it fundamentally changes the definition of what their healing intervention must be. The paper makes a bold statement: justice is an absolute condition of healing.
Justice as a condition of healing, meaning, well, you can't just slap a medical bandage on a profound social injustice and call the person healed.
If a person's environment is historically toxic or deeply unjust, healing cannot simply mean restoring them to that oppressive baseline so they can continue to endure it. If a worker's injury is caused by severe workplace exploitation, healing isn't just treating their physical stress so they can go back to being exploited on the assembly line.
That makes total sense.
True healing requires what the paper calls just transformation. It requires societal acknowledgement of the harm, institutional accountability, and actively changing the structural conditions that caused the injury in the first place.
The paper also connects this philosophy deeply to Indigenous knowledge systems, doesn't it? It explicitly cites the findings of Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the work of the Indigenous Physicians Association of Canada.
Yes, those sources are cited very prominently. The paper argues that this modern life-grounded framework is actually echoing what Indigenous traditions of relational healing, deep connection to the land, and intergenerational responsibility have understood for centuries.
Hmm.
And importantly, integrating this knowledge demands epistemic humility from modern medical institutions.
Epistemic humility. Breaking that down, it means the institution of Western medicine needs to admit it doesn't hold a monopoly on the truth.
It means that massive medical institutions or universities cannot just parachute into a marginalized or indigenous community, define what healing looks like according to their own rigid Western medical metrics, and impose that definition on the community.
They can't just dictate the terms.
True healing requires humility. It requires listening to the community's own definition of what recovery looks like, respecting their data sovereignty, and ensuring that community leaders have actual authority in the process. You cannot claim to facilitate collective healing while simultaneously excluding the community from the power structure.
That is profound. And it ties directly into another massive concept in the paper that extends this idea of justice all the way out to the natural environment, planetary health, and a concept called the non-displacement test.
The non-displacement test is perhaps one of the most stringent and challenging requirements proposed in this entire framework. It dictates that restoring capacity or achieving healing in one specific place or for one specific population cannot depend on obscuring a substantial injury somewhere else.
I was thinking about an analogy for this to make it really concrete. Imagine a state-of-the-art multi-billion dollar hospital in a wealthy city. It boasts about its incredible patient recovery rates, its pristine, perfectly sterile environments, and its cutting-edge technology.
Sounds like a great hospital.
Right. But behind the scenes, it is secretly dumping all of its hazardous, toxic medical waste into the local water supply of the poorer town downstream. Or, internally, it is achieving those great patient outcomes by working its nursing staff into early graves with mandatory, relentless 80-hour work weeks.
That analogy captures the exact systemic hypocrisy the test is designed to expose.
You haven't actually created a net positive of healing in the world. You haven't generated health. You have just geographically and demographically relocated the injury. You moved the suffering from the patients inside your shiny building, and you displaced it onto the community downstream or onto your own workforce.
The framework insists that a healthcare service cannot legitimately claim to provide comprehensive healing if it is systematically externalizing its carbon emissions, its toxic chemical exposures, its labor exploitation, or its ecological destruction onto others.
It's all connected.
Planetary Health emphasizes that human well-being fundamentally, biologically, depends on the condition of the Earth's natural systems. You cannot heal human beings by destroying the planetary life support system they live on.
So if a massive hospital system has a huge carbon footprint that significantly contributes to climate change, which in turn causes more severe prolonged heat waves, which in turn puts more elderly, vulnerable patients into that very same hospital with heat stroke, the system is literally defeating its own purpose.
It creates an endless, self-perpetuating loop of displaced burden. The non-displacement test forces institutional decision makers to make those hidden trade-offs visible. It forces them to redesign their operations so that the care provided in the present moment does not actively erode the ecological and social conditions that future generations will depend on to survive.
We have covered an incredible amount of conceptual ground here. We have unpacked the competency sufficiency error, the internal and external mechanisms of salugenesis and salutogenesis, the six nested levels of healing, the four layers of distributed accountability, the impacts of structural violence, and the non-displacement test of planetary health.
It's a lot to take in.
It is. But if I am sitting here as a dean of a medical school or a medical educator, I might be listening to this and saying, look, this is all great philosophy, but we already teach structural competency in our school. We already have required curriculum modules on the social determinants of health and planetary health. What is Dr. Sekili actually proposing that is fundamentally new for how we train the doctors of tomorrow?
That is the pivotal question of the entire paper.
Mm-hmm.
How do we move from theory to action? Sekili's answer revolves around a concept called the fragmentation thesis.
The fragmentation thesis. Let's break that down.
The paper argues that true, holistic healing didn't disappear from modern medicine because doctors suddenly stopped caring about their patients. It disappeared because our modern institutions systematically divided the continuous work of healing into rigidly isolated silos.
Ah, oh, silos again.
Think about how society is structured today. Medicine is siloed to treat the biological disease. Public health is siloed to track population exposures.
Hmm?
Social services are siloed to address poverty and housing. The justice system handles legal rights. Environmental agencies monitor the climate.
Everyone holds a tiny, fragmented piece of the puzzle. It reminds me of massive corporate structures where the marketing department has no idea what the product development team is doing, and the customer service team is completely cut off from both of them. Everyone is doing their specific job, but the overall customer experience is a nightmare because the systems don't talk to each other.
That corporate analogy translates perfectly to healthcare. No single entity is accountable for the coherence, the continuity, and the completion of the whole picture of a person's recovery. Each silo evaluates itself based solely on its own internal narrow metrics.
Right.
The hospital celebrates a successful surgery. The social worker celebrates opening a case file. But the actual holistic recovery of the human being falls through the gaping cracks between those silos.
So how does this framework propose we rewire the medical education system to fix that fragmentation?
Zedeli proposes a unified educational architecture built on 10 specific domains of competence and 7 entrustable healing activities, which in medical education jargon are called EPAs.
We don't have the time to read through an entire medical school syllabus, but let's highlight a few of the standout domains to show how this practically, day-to-day, changes what a medical student is taught to do.
Let's look closely at domain 4. Structural diagnosis. We touched on the theory this earlier. In practice, this means actively teaching the learner how to identify how housing instability, systemic racism, predatory commercial practices, or unsafe labor conditions are literally shaping the patient's illness.
Okay.
But crucially, it goes beyond just spotting the problem. It is about training the doctor to refuse to blame the patient for failing to navigate inaccessible conditions, and moving from just observing the structure to actively formulating an interprofessional plan to help the patient navigate it.
It is turning sociological observation into clinical action. And then there's domain 7, which, when I read the paper, felt like the absolute linchpin of the whole operational framework. Authority-matched coordination and closed-loop action.
It absolutely is the linchpin. In traditional medical training, a student is often taught a very linear process. If a patient has a severe housing issue, you, the doctor, write a referral to a social worker, you put it in the chart, and your job is officially done. The box is checked.
But Domain 7 fundamentally changes that expectation.
Drastically. Domain 7 and its corresponding educational activity, EPA 4, mandate a closed-loop handoff. The framework states this unequivocally. A referral is not a repair.
A referral is not a repair. That single sentence should be printed on giant banners and hung in the hallways of every hospital in the world.
It really should, because a referral is just a piece of paper or a digital ping. In this life-grounded framework, the medical action is only considered complete when the responsible actor has actually responded to the referral, or when an unresolved barrier has been explicitly escalated to a higher institutional authority. The loop must be closed.
So they have to follow up.
Yes. Did the housing agency actually respond to the social worker? Was the toxic mold actually remediated? If the answer is no, the system has failed, and the hospital institution needs to know that its referral pathway is broken and useless.
Let's apply this closed loop concept to a detailed, real-world scenario provided in the text. The paper gives this very timely case study regarding extreme heat. Imagine an older adult patient. They have chronic kidney disease and congestive heart failure. They live below the poverty line in a poorly insulated apartment, and their city is in the middle of a massive, prolonged, record-breaking heat wave.
It is a scenario that ERs are seeing with alarming frequency as the climate changes. Under a traditional medical model, the doctor's job is strictly limited to the medication review. They check the chart, make sure the kidney and heart medications are dialed in correctly, advise the patient to try to stay cool and hydrated, and send them back out into the heat.
But under the life-grounded framework, sending them home to a sweltering apartment isn't healing. The loop has to be closed.
Yes. The doctor absolutely still does the meticulous medication review, that is, their specific vital clinical authority. But generating health requires more. The doctor, working with the interprofessional team, identifies that the patient has no air conditioning and cannot afford the electricity bill to run a fan, even if they had one. So they initiate and coordinate a closed-loop handoff.
What does that look like?
Maybe a local community agency provides free, accessible transportation to a municipal cooling center. The healthcare institution's role is to ensure that the partnership with that transport agency is active and funded. And scaling up to the governance level, the municipality is responsible for ensuring energy protection policies, so the power company cannot shut off the patient's electricity during a heat wave, while also developing long-term urban canopy plans to plant trees and cool the neighborhood down over the next decade.
And the medical student is trained to trace and participate in that entire pathway. They don't just memorize the pharmacology of the kidney medications. They learn how their prescription fits into the city's heat response plan.
Exactly. And there's one more domain we must highlight because it circles back to your very first concern. Domain 10, practitioner sustainability, boundaries, and reciprocal care.
This goes right back to my worry about asking doctors to do too much and burning them out.
The paper makes a definitive, incredibly protective statement here. It argues that relying on a doctor's individual resilience to survive structural burnout is a massive failure of the institution.
Oh, I love the phrasing of that. So instead of hospital administrators just telling exhausted residents to do more yoga, practice mindfulness, and download a meditation app while forcing them to work 90-hour weeks.
Exactly. The framework formally recognizes that a healthcare workforce cannot reliably support the healing of others if the workers themselves are operating under sustained physical exhaustion, wildly unsafe nurse-to-patient staffing ratios, or the profound moral injury of watching patients suffer because the system is broken. Domain 10 holds the institution strictly responsible for creating the workloads, the staffing levels, and the psychological safety required for the practitioners themselves to maintain their own life capacity. This raises an important question, though, which the paper must answer. If you are fundamentally changing the entire goal of medical education, moving from just making accurate biological diagnoses to participating in closed-loop systemic healing, how on earth do you grade the students?
It's a great point.
And how do you evaluate the hospitals? Because if this is just a beautiful philosophical shift without a hard grading rubric and structural accountability, it will just become another ignored checkbox on a syllabus.
You have hit on the exact reason why so many grand holistic frameworks fail the moment they meet reality. If you don't change how you measure success, you will never change the behavior of the system. Section 6 of the paper is entirely dedicated to making this conceptual model real through rigorous measurement, but it attempts to do so without committing what Saheeli calls measurement violence.
Measurement violence. Let's dig deeply into that. How do we evaluate something this ambitious without breaking it?
Oh, you mean the Donabedian model?
Yes. The paper starts by adapting a very classic, well-respected evaluation model in healthcare quality called the Donabedian model. The traditional Donabedian model looks at three things: structure, process, and outcome. But Saheeli argues that isn't enough and adds crucial new layers to this evaluation: equity, patient agency, and ecological displacement.
Okay, so we aren't just measuring the cold, hard outcome of did the patient live or die. We are actively measuring, was the care provided equitably across different demographics? Did the patient have a meaningful voice in their treatment plan? And did we destroy the local environment to provide the care?
Right. But here is the critical danger, and the paper is very upfront and pragmatic about this. If you start tying a young doctor's literal grades or a hospital's financial funding directly to a massive societal outcome, like did the patient successfully secure safe, affordable housing, you risk creating a deeply perverse incentive.
Right. I can see that immediately. If my grade as a medical student or my year-end bonus as an attending physician depends on my patient getting a house, and I know for a fact there is a massive affordable housing shortage in my city, won't doctors just start avoiding poor patients? Won't hospitals just cherry-pick wealthy, stably housed patients so their institutional metrics look amazing?
Yes. That dynamic is exactly what metric capture or measurement violence looks like in practice.
Yeah.
Is when the metric designed to improve care actually punishes the under-resourced clinic for taking on hard cases. Uh-huh. Or it's when the rigid categories of a measurement tool completely erase the complex lived reality of the most vulnerable patients.
It makes me think of customer service metrics in the corporate world. It is like grading a frontline call center rep on whether a customer's package arrived on time when that rep has literally zero control over the shipping and logistics department. All that metric does is incentivize the rep to hang up on angry customers to keep their call times down because they know they can't fix the shipping issue. It is a toxic metric. So how does this framework prevent that kind of metric capture in medicine?
By meticulously and strictly separating the evaluation of three distinct phases of action: performance, enablement, and outcome.
Performance, enablement, outcome. Break those down for me because this seems like the secret sauce to making the framework function.
Performance is the evaluation of what the learner or the clinician actually did within their sphere of control. Did the medical student recognize the mold in the apartment? Did they document it properly in the chart? Did they initiate the referral to the social worker? That is their performance.
Okay, so that's what the student does. Then enablement is the evaluation of what the institution did. Did the hospital administration actually employ enough social workers to handle the caseload? Do they have a functional, funded legal partnership with a local housing rights group? Did the hospital give the student the protected schedule, time to make that referral?
Exactly. And finally, outcome is the evaluation of what actually happened in society. Did the landlord finally fix the mold? Did the city council enforce the building codes? Did the patient ultimately get a safer house?
Ah, I see how this works now. It separates it out.
The brilliance of the framework is in the separation of accountability. You grade the learner only on their appropriate action within their specific authority. You grade their performance. You absolutely do not grade the learner on the ultimate societal outcome. You evaluate the hospital on its enablement, and you evaluate the government and the society on the outcome.
That is incredibly fair, and it completely protects the practitioner. The medical student gets an A for recognizing the barrier, documenting it, and triggering the alarm, even if the city council ultimately fails to build the affordable housing. The student is protected from the crushing moral injury of feeling like they fail to fix society all by themselves.
Exactly. And conversely, the institution can't just claim it is doing a great job simply because its students are filing a lot of referral paperwork. The institution is aggressively judged on whether those referral pathways actually lead anywhere and have the resources to function.
Okay, so this is undeniably a massive systemic overhaul of how medicine is taught, practiced, and measured. You cannot just flip a switch on a Friday and expect a massive university hospital to operate like this on Monday. Does the paper give a realistic roadmap for how a medical school would actually implement this without collapsing under the weight of the transition?
It does. The paper outlines a very structured, pragmatic, phased 24-month rollout timeline. It explicitly warns institutions not to try and do everything at once.
Map that timeline out for us. How does a school actually begin this transformation?
In phase one, which covers months 1 to 3, the focus is entirely on governance and defining local realities. An institution does not start by writing a syllabus. It starts by creating a steering group. And crucially, this group must include patients, community organizations, and public health partners, not just doctors and deans.
They need actual community input.
Yes. Together, they define what healing actually means for their specific local context and demographics.
Phase two.
Months 4 to 6 are dedicated to mapping. You don't throw away your existing vital clinical curriculum. You map these new 10 domains onto what you already teach. You identify where the gaps in education are. And most critically, the operational teams map out the actual physical referral routes and partnerships in the community. You cannot launch the educational component until the institutional pathways exist in reality.
Right. You can't teach students how to cross bridges that haven't been built yet. It's setting them up for failure.
Precisely. Phase three, covering months 7 to 12, is a highly limited pilot program. You do not roll this out to the entire hospital system. You pick one or two specific recurring systemic problems, like environmentally aggravated pediatric asthma or heat-related illness in vulnerable elderly populations. You test the closed-loop handoffs in just one or two clinical settings to see where the friction points are.
And then phase four, the final year of the rollout.
Months 13 to 24 are for rigorous evaluation and adaptive cautious expansion. You measure the results of the pilot. Did the barriers to healing actually get addressed? But most importantly, the institution checks itself. Did this new process create unsustainable administrative burden on the clinicians? Did the doctors burn out?
Right, checking on domain 10.
Yes. If the workload protections failed, the institution must fix them before expanding the program. Only when the evidence shows the system works and the staff is protected do you cautiously expand the curriculum to other departments.
It is incredibly methodical. It treats the rollout with the same precision as a clinical trial. And it is important to note for our listeners, this framework isn't just academic science fiction. Dr. Saley is pulling together threads and concepts that are already starting to weave their way into the mainstream of medical education globally.
Absolutely. The paper does not claim to invent all these concepts out of thin air. It explicitly cites several major real-world precedents where these ideas are already taking root.
Right. The text mentions the CAN-MD's framework refresh happening in Canada, which is actively pushing to integrate these broader societal competencies into the definition of what a doctor is. It mentions McGill University's longstanding physicianship program, which has explicitly taught the concept of the physician as healer, navigating both the science and the art of medicine for years.
It also points to brand new ground-up institutions. Places like the developing Simon Fraser University Medical School in British Columbia and the Alice L. Walton School of Medicine in the U.S. These are institutions that are literally building their foundational curricula around the concepts of whole health, community engagement, and planetary health from day one, rather than trying to retrofit them into an old system.
So the individual pieces of the puzzle are already out there in the world, operating in their own respective silos. What Dr. Saley is doing here is providing the unifying architecture. The paper is the blueprint that shows how to snap all those disparate pieces together into one coherent, functioning, accountable system.
That captures the essence of the paper perfectly. The framework doesn't invent the individual parts. It provides the overarching purpose that connects the parts. It is a roadmap to move us from a healthcare system that is satisfied with isolated clinical excellence to a system that demands and builds life-enabling institutions.
What an incredible journey this has been. We have moved all the way from the microscopic cellular danger response, the internal biological work of cellulogenesis, up through the physical functioning of the body. We zoomed out into the patient's relationships, out into the moldy apartments and the housing laws, out into the hospital infrastructure and the city policies, all the way up to planetary climate systems and the absolute necessity of not displacing our environmental burdens.
It really covers everything.
It does. We have seen clearly that healing is not a solo act. It is never just performed by a herotic doctor with a stethoscope and a prescription pad. Healing is a massive, interconnected team sport. It requires doctors, interprofessional teams, institutional administrators, and society at large to all play their specific, authority-matched roles in a continuous loop.
And it serves as a powerful reminder that while we cannot always cure every biological disease, and we cannot reverse every physical vulnerability, we have a profound collective obligation to stop actively causing harm through our social structures, and to build the conditions where the process of healing is always made possible.
So, what does this all mean? We have spent this entire time talking about doctors, emergency rooms, and medical schools. But the underlying philosophy we've unpacked here, the idea that you cannot just look at an isolated intervention without looking at the entire ecosystem it lives within, applies to absolutely everything.
In the universal systems perspective, it applies far beyond the walls of a hospital.
It really does. So I want to leave you, our listener, with a final thought to mull over as you go about your day. If we are demanding that our massive healthcare systems stop acting in isolation, and if we are demanding that they start measuring their success by the ecological and social conditions they leave behind, shouldn't we apply that exact same non-displacement test to our own industries?
That is a great question.
Think about your own work. Whether you work in tech, in finance, in retail, in manufacturing, or in education, are the cures or the brilliant solutions you are providing for your clients inadvertently shifting a toxic burden onto your workforce, your local community, or the planet? Are you treating the immediate symptom of your business, hitting your quarterly metrics, but completely ignoring the structural conditions you are creating downstream?
It really forces you to look at the big picture.
Exactly. What would it look like if your workplace, your specific industry, stopped operating in a silo and actually became an engine for true life-grounded healing? It is a massive, uncomfortable question, but maybe it is the exact question we all need to be asking if we want to build a world where flourishing is actually possible. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.